Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. In Iowa, approximately 4% of the population is African American. In this predominantly white state, Black voices are often overshadowed. All week long, I'll be talking with Black Iowans about their lives, experiences, and ideas. Today, we begin with four Iowans who felt a call to action this summer, participating in and leading protests against police violence after George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer. All four of the people I'll talk with this hour have built organizations with a vision for the future, continuing to advocate for policy changes that combat systemic racism, raising awareness, investing in community building, and supporting individuals in need. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Justin Lewis, founder of Des Moines Selma, and Zakaria Hill and Aaliyah Quinn, the founders of The Supply Hive. My first guest today never expected to find himself leading protests, but the killing of George Floyd changed everything. This is the voice of Tere Morrow of Cedar Rapids speaking at a protest against police violence at Green Square in Cedar Rapids back in June.
We are angry because we can't be handcuffed and put in a car unless we are dead. George Floyd. We can't go bird watching in Central Park, Christian Cooper. We can't go jogging, Ahmaud Arbery. We can't relax in the comfort of our own homes, Sean and Atiana Jefferson. We can't ask for help after being in the car crash, Jonathan Farrell and Renisha McBride. We can't have a cell phone, Stephon Clark. We can't leave a party and get to safety, Jordan Edwards. We can't play loud music, Jordan Davis. We can't sell CDs, Alton Sterling. We can't sleep, Ayanna Jones. We can't walk from the corner store, Mike Brown. We can't play cops and robbers, Tamir Rice. We can't go to church, Charleston Nine. We can't walk home with Skittles, Trayvon Martin. We can't hold a hairbrush while we leave our fashion party, Sean Bell. My white brothers and sisters, if you have not heard me speak, and this is the first time that you have seen me or met me, I need to let you know right now, I love you. I love all of you. You are my heroes. And I just want y'all to know we tired. We just tired. We tired.
That is the voice of Tere Morrow of Cedar Rapids. He took a leadership role in this summer's Black Lives Matter protests in the city, and the chant and rallying cry, We Are CR, inspired him to found a nonprofit called We Are CR. He is on the line with me now. Tere Morrow, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's my pleasure.
You gave such an incredible speech, and you've been so involved in founding and leading through We Are CR. Had you ever been involved in activism before this summer?
Until this summer, I had never organized any protests, but I had attended some.
What changed for you? What made you feel like it was time for you to speak and you to lead?
The second protest that we had here in Cedar Rapids, I was armed with a megaphone. And other people that attended the protest, I guess they kind of assumed that I was the leader or a protest organizer, and people just started following me. When it got to the point where I was like, yo, well, I'm going to fall back because I really didn't have any intentions on being a leader in this movement, and a lot of people supported me playing the role that I played.
When you found yourself kind of thrust into that role, Did you start thinking about your role and your mission differently once people started looking to you?
I did. I think anybody in that position would have had no choice but to reanalyze their role and their contribution to the movement at that point.
Let's talk a little bit about you and your life in Cedar Rapids. You moved to Cedar Rapids from Chicago back in 1994. What drew you to Cedar Rapids?
My father had moved here, and when I spoke with him in 1994, he was explaining to me how Iowa is so family-friendly, and that pretty much sold me on it.
How old were you when you moved here?
I was 19. Moving to Cedar Rapids from Chicago was a complete culture shock. I was used to being surrounded by gangs and gang activity and gang violence. When I moved here, none of that was happening.
It felt safe.
It felt extremely safe.
I want to talk more about the protests that came about this summer. You had a rallying cry, "We are CR." What does that mean to you?
That means that we are all a part of the Cedar Rapids community. We all have a duty and an obligation to protect Cedar Rapids.
So much of the property destruction that we did see in other cities, now some of it was perpetrated by people who weren't part of those communities. Some of it was people who were part of communities, and they were angry and they were fed up. And a lot of people have said, hey, that's understandable that things got burned down and windows got broken. That didn't happen in Cedar Rapids, and that was really important to you. Why is that so important?
Because at the end of the day, we still have to live here. Yes, we were angry. I was angry too. These are black people. I'm a black man. These are black people that we're talking about. So yes, I was angry too. I was not angry enough to tear up my city. I was not angry enough to let somebody else come and tear up my city. Because tomorrow, when it's all over with, when it's all said and done, we still need to go shopping. We still need Pampers. We still need milk. So it did not seem prudent to me, even through our anger, to tear up our city. It didn't seem prudent to me for us to tear up our businesses, the places where we work at, to pay our bills, the places that we shop at to feed our families. That just didn't seem prudent to me.
Do you feel like your voice and the voices of other protesters, other black Iowans who live in Cedar Rapids, do you feel like your voices were heard by the city and by the Cedar Rapids Police Department?
I do. The city of Cedar Rapids have heard our demand for a citizens review board, and they've moved towards that. They've heard our demands to decriminalize marijuana, and they're making movements towards that. So,
for people who may not understand why the decriminalization of marijuana is so important, tell me a little bit more about that. Why is that such a key issue in this movement?
Okay, here in Cedar Rapids, in Iowa, a black person is 10 times more likely to have an interaction with the police. Now, because they are 10 times more likely to have an interaction with the police, they are 10 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana. That's not to say that black people are using marijuana 10 times more than white people. We're just more likely to get arrested for it because we're more likely to have an interaction with the police.
Yeah. there were protests throughout the summer, and then there was the derecho on August 10th, and WeRCR became a big part of rebuilding and cleaning up after the derecho. Tell me what you feel like this group is turning into.
I feel like WeRCR is turning into a community project that is involved in anything regarding the community. We are currently in the process of building a neighborhood watch program. We are trying to develop a program in which we're dealing with the gun violence in the communities. We're trying to find a way where we can communicate with these young people who are committing these crimes and find a way to resolve their issues without things turning violent.
What happens next? What do you hope is the next step?
Oh, man. A dreamer dreams. But with the successes that we've made, I hope that we can move in a sector where we can help to finance people who are needing stable residences. I hope to be able to help people pay for a deposit on an apartment, or help them pay their rent, or help pay a light bill or a gas bill that they may be behind on. I hope that we can get to a point where WeRCR can help anybody that's destitute, anybody that's in need of anything. I want WeRCR to be able to help with whatever somebody may need.
Tere, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Tere Morrow emerged as a leader during the Black Lives Matter protest that took place this summer in Cedar Rapids. He is the founder of the nonprofit WeRCR. Coming up, we'll meet three other Iowa activists galvanized by the events of this summer. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices on Iowa Public Radio. We continue in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps training program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week, listening to Black voices. All week long, we'll hear from Black Iowans sharing their stories, experiences, and ideas. Today, activists who've been advocating for change. In about 15 minutes, we'll meet the women behind Supply Hive, a new nonprofit that grew out of this summer's protests. And with me now is Justin Lewis. He's a Des Moines native and small business owner. He's also the founder of Des Moines Selma, another nonprofit group that grew out of this summer's protests. The group describes itself this way: where the movement of BLM and solidarity meet, where all races join together for Black lives, social justice, and government accountability. Justin, thank you so much for being with me today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And I want to start by going back in time. You did grow up in Des Moines, and growing up in Des Moines wasn't always easy. Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges.
So I've seen, the best way to say it, my share of racial discrimination, racial violence. Growing up on the east side, I was a victim of a hate crime. I was beat up by a teenager that was racially motivated. I've also been chased down streets by men calling us N-words and literally pouring out of their house, running to their truck, and telling us we don't belong in the street. And we had to take shelter in a neighbor, a garage at that time that we didn't know. It was just a friendly face that was ready to harbor us and shelter us from the guys that were chasing us in the truck. And then from there, just my friends' personal stories and my brothers, There's a lot of untold stories that take place to African Americans, and sadly, we just don't share them because we don't want to hear, you know, protests towards our reality. We don't want to hear like, oh, that couldn't really happen. So we just decide to live with those experiences, and we try to avoid the places that we know that can give us a little bit of pushback. So a few of those experiences were back in the 90s. I've had some other stories, but that would take up this full show. So, yeah.
And as a kid, as a teenager, did you share what was going on with anybody, or did you just think this is part of what I have to put up with to stay alive?
With other incidents where we were chased, we told my mother, but there was not too much we could do because we couldn't really pinpoint where and who did those things at that time. We were really filled with fear, and so we just left. And my mom's like, don't go back down that street ever again. So, yeah, there's instances where you do make reports and you are talking to people. But at the end of the day, there's not too much that can be done unless the heart of man has changed. So yeah, those are instances of that. I've seen my mom called the N-word multiple times in her presence. So there's a lot that can be done and changed, and I'm hopeful for Iowa in the future because I'm seeing people wake up to the fact that, oh my gosh, you know, the Black community is experiencing a lot and we should be doing better.
You went to Iowa State University. You are the first person in your family to graduate from college. And mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you went to Iowa State, did you feel like you had escaped that kind of treatment, that kind of overt racism, or did you encounter it at school too?
Right. So like, I would say like, so my upbringing, like I had friends of all races, so I got along with everyone. Like I'm just a big lover. I care about people. My superpower, I would say, is I'm extremely vulnerable. I'm extremely empathetic. Like I can feel other people's emotions. So with that, I just try to approach everybody in life with a fair shake, like no matter who you are. So going to Iowa State, I was just trying to make friends and get along with everyone. But then you still have those instances where, you know, not everyone's like empathetic or knows your background or experience, so they're going to treat you differently. So you have small town kids, sadly, who don't have a diverse background, you know, closing doors in front of your face when you're trying to come into the party that everyone got the invite to, or yelling, hey, there's this Black guy. I don't really want this Black guy in this party with us. Like, I heard those instances. You know, those hurt your feelings. They hurt your heart. But, you know, I take those experiences and I use them to continue to encourage me that there's so much work that needs to be done. So when I'm teaching about implicit bias, I'm sharing these experiences and why they're wrong and the importance of sharing diversity in American history with our children as we're raising them. So, yeah, I guess that'd be my experience at Iowa State. I loved it. I'm a Iowa State fan through and through. And I'm a very proud alum, so.
Let's talk about your experience as an activist. I mean, you've worked with people with implicit bias training. You've obviously been dedicated for a long time to helping people move toward equality. But what really galvanized you and turned you into an activist?
Right. I would say it was when Trayvon Martin was killed, and seeing the responses from, you know, friends and family, white friends and white family, and the response to blaming him for his own murder, I think that was what really initially shook my reality. I initially thought right is right and wrong is wrong. I didn't know that we all perceived the world in a different lens at that point. I thought people could have just saw that this man was targeted, chased down, and murdered by, you know, a neighborhood watchman. And that's what kind of really started my activism. I've always been taught about my Black history through from my mother. She's been amazing with how she raised us. But just knowing the history in the background and the story of African Americans in America helps me understand the moment that we're in. But I can remember the most pinnacle point was when Trayvon Martin was killed, and that's when I really started speaking out on Facebook, and then I finally got involved with NAACP and IOSCCI, on the racial justice group. And then finally George Floyd took place and showed up to a few marches. And I know, studying politics, I know what divides us. I've been involved politically with both parties, so I know the hot buttons and the taglines each party uses. And for the last, since I've studied politics, I take detailed notes on what leaders say, what they do, and what divides us. And I realize that racial issues is used to divide us, and how can I present it in a way that brings unity? And that's what really Des Moines Summit is trying to do. We're trying to educate the public, inform the public, but also share history and context and why we are in this current climate that we are. So yeah, we're trying to stay clear out of the weeds of politics, just speak truth to the moment, speak facts, and give experiences that will speak to the conscience of the normal everyday American, and empower them to do something.
What made you decide that you needed to found Des Moines Selma? I mean, there are a number of different groups that have been involved in protests this summer, and you mentioned mm-hmm. a couple of the other organizations that you're actively involved with. What was the need that you feel Des Moines Selma can fill?
Right. So I know one of the main things is that as my journey through life, I realized that a lot of people have questions that they're scared to ask. I know mainly one of its Republicans, I've saw them dive into the movement of recently and asking questions like, what can I do? I don't understand. I want them to know that this is a safe organization for them to come learn, get trained up, do become an ally. And then on the other side, you know, people that have already been doing the work, this is a space for you as well. Like, you can come. We're going to continue to be activists. We're still going to show up on the streets when things take place in our community. But also, we want to bring both sides together so we can get things done. African Americans represent less than 5% of the population in Iowa. So I know that we need all people to be champions of diversity. We need all people to understand the experience of African Americans. We want to bring everyone together under this movement so we can get change.
How do you help white Iowans, for example, understand that racism hurts everybody? How do you help them feel like they have also something at stake beyond a moral obligation?
Right. Oh, absolutely. That's a great question. Thanks for asking that one. So we know that Citibank, for instance, I believe, and I think JP Morgan, they both put out reports discussing the economy and the fact that we have hurt the economy by not loaning, making mortgage loans and business loans out to the black community. They said it struck and hit the economy up to about $19 trillion. So what they were trying to say is that because our practices of not making these loans for African Americans and not giving out business loans, the economy did not grow to a point where we were expecting. So now we see banks discussing lending and earmarking money so that they can help change this practice. So there's a monetary benefit to it. But then also, it's the climate. So we're nothing's going to change if we don't have these tough discussions. We're going to pass the bucket down to our children, and they're going to have to resolve the problems that we have ample opportunity to change right now. So I guess that's what my message would be to white Iowans, is that change can happen with us, and we don't have to be the ones to delay it any further. And that's by having hard conversations with someone that's doesn't look like you, who has a different experience like you. But then also I want to say, not just having hard conversations and saying, I have a black friend, I'm not racist, but honestly looking within yourself and saying, what can I do to be a better Iowan for all people?
This summer, I know it's been an incredibly heartbreaking and difficult time for so many people involved in the social justice movement and just for so many people, period. Mm-hmm. But it's also been a time of hope. We have seen crowds come together and we've seen more white people marching in these social justice marches than we have in the past. There has been a lot of momentum. Do you feel like this is something that is being sustained?
So I have seen some protest numbers go down. I think what's important is for, you know, that engagement, that civic engagement, which has been historically a problem for America all this, since the beginning of time. You know, people don't usually stay locked into these issues only around election year. And we're working on some curriculum. We're working on videos, and we're going to work on a podcast to keep the Iowan mind busy and focus on the task that we have at hand. So we are very cautious of that. But as of right now, we are seeing our numbers tick up on Des Moines Summer. We're seeing our following continuing to increase. So it's hard for me to say that if the movement's dying, but I know with our organization, we are going to make it sustainable with the stories that we share and the experiences that we share, but even the history that we're going to share. I say all the time, we are in this moment because of where we've come from. And we have to understand where we're coming from to understand where we're going. And I think that's what's key to sustaining this movement and actually getting change for the community. And then from there, building unity through understanding.
You grew up in Des Moines not very long ago. Now you're raising two kids in Des Moines. Do you feel like things are going to be better and easier for them than they were for you?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, Des Moines is a beautiful city. I love it so much dearly. This is my home, and this is where I will continue to raise my kids and be a part of the community. So I have aspirations to run for city council in the next few years. This is me. This is where I'm at. We see through data that it is a wonderful place to raise children. But also on the flip side, there's a survey and some data that it's quite difficult and hard to be African American here, whether it's, you know, housing, whether it's the job market, whether it's lending for businesses. So yeah, there's that flip side. What I really truly visualize is, you know, corporations and organizations really being informed on their hiring practices, not going outside the scope of hiring. If you do have a metric, stick to that metric. Don't just hire your buddy. And we're looking to create a hiring metric and a hiring tracking process so organizations can just use to hire qualified candidates, but hire qualified candidates of diversity. And then just digging into why doesn't your organization have the representation that it needs and you're proclaiming that you want? So I think Des Moines is at a beautiful position right now. It's a great city. It's a clean city. It's a beautiful city. It's a growing city. And there's so much potential for entrepreneurs. I'm an entrepreneur as well. But there's just some slight changes that need to be made for it can, you know, feel like a true safe haven, a beacon. And honestly, what I would really love is Des Moines to be like an example throughout the nation for all cities. And not only that, word gets out to other African Americans that, hey, this is a place where you can come, grow, be safe, business is bustling, and you will be able to find a home and raise a family. That's what I visualize Des Moines as a multicultural city. And I believe we'll get there. I do believe we'll truly get there. And I'm excited for the future. So,
Justin Lewis, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Justin Lewis is a small business owner and activist who lives in Des Moines. He is the founder of Des Moines Selma, a nonprofit group that describes itself this way: where the movement of BLM and solidarity meet, where all races join together for Black lives, social justice, and government accountability. In a moment, we'll meet two more young Black activists and community organizers living in Des Moines, the co-founders of The Supply Hive. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices on Iowa Public Radio. We just want to break chains like slaves in the South, started in the North End, but we in the downtown. Riot cops try to block, now we got a showdown. Down. I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly. In the name of the people of California. You should have been downtown. The people are rising. We thought it was a lockdown. They opened the fire. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. After George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis, people all over the country took to the streets to protest police violence, particularly police violence directed at Black Americans. Zakaria Hill and Aaliyah Quinn, childhood friends from Des Moines, joined the protests, but they also wanted to do something more to support the protesters, to build community, to make Des Moines and Iowa a safer and better place for Black lives. Together, they co-founded the Supply Hive, a nonprofit now based in Des Moines. Their stated mission is to provide a space of nourishment through extraordinary times in order to build leaders in local communities. And Zakaria and Aaliyah are on the line with me now. Hello, Zakaria.
Hello, Charity.
And hello, Aaliyah.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you both so much for being here. And Zakaria, in addition to starting this nonprofit this summer, you are a student at Iowa State University, right?
Yes, studying management information systems.
All right. And Aaliyah, are you studying at Drake?
Yes, I am. I'm doing elementary education with an endorsement in ESL.
Wow. So you're both incredibly busy, full-time students, starting a nonprofit. Yes. Zakaria, can you tell me what the inspiration was for creating the Supply Hive in the midst of all of these protests?
So I have been protesting day one after George Floyd's death, and it was about day five I woke up and I'm like, I got to do more. Like, I can't just keep showing up with a sign saying the same chants. Like, it's in me to want to do more to help myself, to help my community. And that's when I got in contact with Aaliyah right away to help this whole thing, the Supply Hive, come into fruition. And since then, we've been rocking and rolling.
What was your original thought with the Supply Hive, Zakaria? What did you think you would be able to do with it?
I thought it was going to be a couple day thing. Just get in there, serve some meals, help protesters stay hydrated and healthy for maybe about a week. But then donations kept coming in, offers were on the table to do more events and outreach. And so we started with a BLM tattoo event in June, and we had about 300-400 people show up for that. From there, we rolled into a Celebration of Black Motherhood event, which was Aaliyah's idea. She's a Black mother herself. From there, the rest is history.
Aaliyah, as you and Zakaria and others, of course, were feeding those protesters, nourishing the protest movement, was there a moment for you when you realized we could do so much more with this?
Yes, I agree with Zakaria. I feel like just going out and holding a sign wasn't enough for me. I wanted to figure out ways I could help the community and help the protesters out there more than just holding a sign up. So that's when we thought of the idea of giving out food and water and medical supplies. And then we thought of, okay, we can continue to do this and host our own events. And so I thought of the idea of the Celebration of Black Motherhood because I wanted Black mothers to be represented, because I am a young Black mom myself. I know that sometimes it can be hard because black women are like the most neglected person in America. And being a mother as well on top of that can be hard. So I wanted to celebrate them and give them the spotlight. And we weren't only celebrating just black mothers. We're celebrating all mothers because motherhood could be hard for everyone.
Well, and I thought you were wildly busy when I thought you were just a college student who started a nonprofit. I didn't know you were also a mom in the middle of a pandemic
yes,
at
I
the
am.
Same time. But Aaliyah, I know that reaching out to Black mothers, we know, of course, that there are so many challenges that Black mothers face in this country, and a lot of them are medical challenges because Black women... Mm-hmm. have a higher mortality rate due to giving mm-hmm. birth, and Black infants have a higher mortality rate. There's obviously something that has gone really terribly wrong here. Mm-hmm. In supporting Black mothers, what do you want, not just the women and the community that you're connecting with, what do you want others to know about Black mothers in this moment in time?
Well, yeah, you are correct. Like, during the hospital, with my hospital visit, I was honestly nervous. I didn't know if I was going to go in there and I was going to be mistreated, or I was not. This was going to be my last day to see the light of day, because I've noticed a lot of Black women, we do get mistreated in the hospitals, whether it's just to do an easy checkup or if it's to give birth and delivery. So I really want Black mothers to be represented and noticed, because it is hard to be a mother and on top of being a Black woman. And I just feel like they should be praised, and people should know that we are working our hardest, even though the world is coming after us all the time. We still continue to keep our head up and protect our babies. And we want our babies to be safe in this world as well, because we know that they are going to grow up that day to be a Black woman or a Black male. And they need to know that sometimes people look at you because of the color of your skin.
You guys also organized derecho relief when Iowa got hit by that terrible derecho on August 10th. Zakaria, tell me what you were able to do with that.
So I took two trips out there early, just right after it hit.
To Cedar Rapids?
Donations. Yes, to Cedar Rapids. The first trip, we had a huge horse trailer filled to the brim with supplies. And we didn't really have a plan going out there. We just knew that we had to get the supplies to the people in need. And so we drove through the neighborhoods and just yelled outside of the car with our megaphone, "Who needs supplies? Come get them." Like we're an ice cream truck or something. And during the midst of that, I would collect some stories and firsthand testimonies of how people were feeling after the derecho. And I heard some tragic stories, and it all comes back and falls on top of the people that were elected and did not step up to have the resources in place to aid civilians.
I hear echoes of what you're saying about the derecho recovery with the Black Lives Matter movement, stories that aren't being heard, that aren't being told, that aren't being listened to. So that's part of why I've asked both of you to talk with me today. And Zakaria, I'll let you go first. We have had this summer of protest and a summer of exploration through many different kinds of media about the systemic racism in our country. This is something that I've talked with some other activists about, who say, you know, this systemic racism gets rediscovered by white people every few years and then nothing happens. Does this feel different to you?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I'm only 22, but I'm tired. So I can only imagine how elders who have been through the civil rights movement feel, and it really does seem to come up every election year. But yeah, I mean, we're chugging away and trying to make a difference, make a change, and just get people to see each other as humans. That's when it comes down to. It doesn't come down to looks, sex, class, race, ethnicity. It comes down to the character that people show and how people show up for others. And so that was one driving force of mine, to show up for others every day through the supply hive and incorporate community. And with that in our mission statement, how we want to build leaders in local communities, that's what I hope it'll be a domino effect that other people can feel and can show up for those in their community. So it doesn't fall on Black people to do the work every time. It falls on white people who are the ones that created the problem to begin with to translate or help their fellow white people understand and just, yeah, keep chugging away.
Part of what both of you are hoping with the supply hive and hoping with the Black Lives Matter movement as well is that young people will get meaningfully engaged. Aaliyah, tell me more about that. What are your hopes for young activists of all backgrounds?
I just hope we get heard because, like Zakaria said, we are all tired. We notice, like, with our ancestors and elders, like, they've been fighting for years. So we know that that's going to happen. We're going to continue to fight for years, but we need to continue to stand by each other and have allies that they will continue to educate their people and their peers. And so we're not doing this work and we're not tiring ourselves out because it is tiring. It's hard to continue to wake up every day and have to teach someone and educate someone about issues that are like right there in their face. We need white people to stand up and they need to continue to tell their other friends and their other peers, whether it's a white person or another person of color that's other than Black, I feel like they need to continue to educate them and tell them, like, we need to continue to work hard.
A lot of people who have been involved in the movement this summer are, I guess, politically organizing. And with Supply Hive, that feels different to me in building the community with this nurturing support. While I'm sure both of you have strong political views, it feels like you're taking a little bit different path. Zakaria, do you have anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, I will say just overall politics, it comes down to so many different things. And morality is one of those things that seems to be in question, but it really shouldn't be like between what's right and what's wrong. And so we're trying to stand on the side of what's right and building community, not having to put trust into governmental systems. We want to get the community together to find some type of harmony and provide for others out of their own free will and goodwill, whether it's through our community garden or the supply drives and events we put on. But yeah, morality cannot be argued.
What do you feel, if you could tell really white Iowans, all Iowans, one thing about what it's like to be a Black Iowan that you don't think people understand? Zakaria, what would you want to say?
Iowa nice is a myth. I hear it all the time. I hear about how nice Iowans are. And don't get me wrong, I love Iowa. I grew up with a white family. My mom is white and my dad is Black, but I grew up with my predominantly white family and I get the Iowa nice in my own family, but it's just an excuse to passive aggressively spread ignorance. It comes in little microaggressions or just little things, but Black people feel it. It sends waves and it crushes souls, honestly. Like, it sounds like a big word, but the little things, when it comes down to not knowing how to pronounce my name or asking to touch my hair, commenting on my clothes and saying words like urban or assuming I like stereotypical Black things, no matter how nice you are, those are things that really affect Black Iowans. So I hope that Iowans can open their minds to new ways of thinking, be more open-minded, and get in touch with other cultures, other backgrounds, religions, races, and not think that the world around them is changing so much or getting radical, but rather that people are coming into themselves. And I hope that people can adapt with that and change themselves.
Aaliyah, how about you? As a young Black mother, a student, and now the founder of a nonprofit, you've been engaged in these conversations about race all summer long, but what do you think is not being heard? What do you want to be heard?
Well, I agree with Zakaria. I've noticed it. I feel like all my life being raised here in Iowa, I've seen things where I feel like, yeah, that whole representation of and that whole thing of Iowa nice is not, it's not nice. And so I feel like I really noticed it my first year of college when I went to a predominantly white institution. I've noticed comments and I noticed a lot of people use that excuse of, well, I came from a small town, so I don't know better. But you do know better. So that always like rubbed me the wrong way. And I feel like with the election in 2016, that kind of like had people show their true colors in Iowa. And it's very scary to see that, but it's always been there. But I feel like they just became bolder in 2016. And a lot of people are just don't care. They don't hold back anymore. They say things that are hurtful to Black people in Iowa and make Black people feel unsafe in here. I feel like they do use a lot of microaggressions. I notice a lot when I do interviews or when I do any type of like news thing and I say something, a lot of white people comment, oh, I'm so impressed by what you said. Like, and it kind of makes me feel like, do you not expect me to speak this way? Do you, you don't think I'm educated enough to respond in this way? So I feel like a lot of Black people, we do deal with a lot of things here in Iowa, and it is getting scary because a lot of them are bold now. A lot of them do not care. They will say some stuff that is very hurtful and very, it feels like they're threatening you. And I feel like I've noticed it a lot from just the election in 2016. I feel like it's been getting worse. And so I just feel like, yeah, it is hard being Black in Iowa. It gets scary. Sometimes it's nerve-wracking just driving in your car with, you never know if like a police officer will stop you. You don't ever know if what's going to happen next when you leave that door from your home. So it is kind of scary. And there's a lot of things going on in Iowa where you always have to stay, make sure you are guard up and you know, and you're aware of what your surroundings are.
Well, I want to thank both of you for sharing your voices with us today and for nourishing our communities and our state. Aaliyah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
And Zakaria, thank you.
Thank you.
Zakaria Hill and Aaliyah Quinn are the co-founders of The Supply Hive in Des Moines. Their stated mission is to provide a space of nourishment through extraordinary times in order to build leaders in local communities. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. All week long, we'll hear from Black Iowans sharing their stories, experiences, and ideas. Tomorrow, I'll talk with State Representative Roz Smith, Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Conference of Branches, and Rachel Rockwell of the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. Black Iowans in leadership. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.